If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
5 a.m., I'm up with a crisp Celsius energy drink. Running 12 miles today. Grab a green juice, quick change, and head to work. Meetings, workshops, one more Celsius, no slowing down. Working late, but obviously still meeting the girls for a little dancing. Celsius, live, fit, go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands for the super athletic stuff, like running gear for cruising up the trail.
Woo!
And the super athletic-ish stuff, like fishing gear for chilling by the creek. Nice cast. Fitness apparel to push for higher reps. You got this. And golf balls priced so you can afford to lose one. Or a few. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Transform the way you hunt with the all-new Base cellular trail camera connected by the Moultrie mobile app. Moultrie mobile's industry-best app gives you complete control over your camera settings, up-to-the-minute updates from the field, and other interactive scouting tools on your smartphone or computer. Features like weather forecast, advanced species recognition, interactive maps, and a whole lot more. For more information and to make your purchase, visit www.moultriemobile.com.
Mic check. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Hunting Gear Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and today we're going to be talking with Brian Malone. Brian works at Pradco, and Pradco is a holding company for brands like Summit and Whitetail Institute and Code Blue, and there's some other brands there. Moultrie is one of them. And so this particular podcast isn't necessarily into specific brands per se, but more of a look behind the curtain about product development, how a company will decide whether or not they want to upgrade a product, whether they want to introduce a new product, whether they want to introduce new technology into a product or product line, or compete in a category that maybe they don't have any experience in. And so it's a really good look behind the curtain in how companies kind of make decisions. And Brian over there is the GM of, I believe his title is the GM of product development over there at Pradco, certain brands over there at Pradco. And so it's a really interesting, thought-provoking, conversation. You get a little bit of a look on how these companies make their decisions, and that's why I got these guys on. And it's something a little bit different. It's not necessarily product-specific, but I love the conversation nonetheless. Before we get into today's episode, though, I do want to take a minute here and talk about the brands that help support the Nine Finger Chronicles. Excuse me. This isn't the Nine Finger Chronicles. This is the Hunting Gear Podcast. So the brands that help support the Hunting Gear Podcast, and that is Tethered. If you're looking for a saddle, definitely go check out Tethered. I am really excited in the next couple weeks to get out there and start putting my saddle to use. I'm really looking forward to that. So if you're looking for a saddle, saddle accessories, climbing sticks, even information on how to use a saddle, go check out Tethered. Next is Hunt Stand. Hunt Stand has just come out with a brand new upgrade that you guys, if you listened to the last episode, it was Friday of last week, there's been a big upgrade and push for their Pro Whitetail. And so there's been a whole bunch of upgrades to the app, like a rut map indicator, new satellite imagery, what was the other one? So predicted deer movement, that kind of stuff. All on the app now. So make sure you go over to huntstand.com, read up on all the new functionality with this Pro Whitetail upgrade, and see if it's something that you'd be interested in, man. I tell you, I've messed around with it just for a little bit because it's a fairly new release. And I can definitely see the functionality for the Eastern Whitetail hunter for sure. So huntstand.com. And then last, but definitely not least, if you're looking to capture your hunts on camera, go check out the new 6.0 Tacticam that can be mounted to your gun or your bow, or like even, I think they even sell brackets for like over the shoulder mounting and things like that. But this new 6.0 version has image stabilization. It has, I believe it's 4K. And it has an LCD screen that you can actually set up and view what you're looking at. So it's a badass camera. I really feel that if you guys are into filming yourself, capturing these moments, and whether it's for a YouTube channel or whether it's just for your own, you know, save it on your computer and go back and show your friends and or your kids what you saw that day, definitely a camera you should go check out, and you can go check out Tacticam. So there's that. All right. Those are the commercials. Huge shout out to all the brands. Huge shout out to Brian. And then huge shout out to all of you for taking time out of your day to hop on and listen to this podcast. Really appreciate it. And if you're out there starting the grind, good luck. Stay positive. Be safe. Check your equipment. Make sure your shot is on and all that stuff. So let's get into today's episode. 3, 2, 1. All right, on the phone with me today, Mr. Brian Malone. Brian, how we doing, man?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm doing good, doing good. All right, so you have to let me know before we kick this off, where do you currently live?
Live in Birmingham, Alabama.
Okay, all right. So Alabama's deer hunting season is in right now, right?
Actually, it's not. So it comes in this coming Saturday. So
really?
Again, you know, Growing up in the Northeast, lived in the Midwest for a little while. It was a little bit of an adaptation to move down here into the South, especially in Alabama, where, you know, the seasons run a little bit later, the fawns drop a lot later, the rut's a lot later. So yeah, our archery season starts this coming Saturday, and then we got about a month archery, and then essentially from mid-November until early February, it's gun season down here.
Yeah. Yeah. So I got a buddy who lives down in, I believe it's Huntsville. And he hunts all over northern Alabama. I actually used to live in Hartselle and work in Huntsville like 20 years ago. But he really likes hunting Alabama and the South. And he's from Texas, and he's bounced all over the South. And he's found a way to get it done. But with you being coming from the Northeast, do you still have a preference over what you like hunting versus where you're currently at?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I love the Midwest. I love the Northeast for hunting. you know, still have some leases up in Illinois that, you know, I'll be going to next month when the time's right. But the other nice thing is, you know, Alabama is very liberal with their bag limits.
Oh, yeah.
The deer are, you know, 100 pounds less than they are anywhere else in the country. And currently right here in central Alabama, and what attracted me to it when this opportunity came up about 6 years ago when I moved here, is it's absolutely beautiful. It's right here. We've got right close to Double Oak Mountain. So a lot of people picture, you know, Alabama as being, you know, cotton fields and rice fields and everything else just flat as a pancake. And really there's quite a bit of elevation right here in Birmingham, and a lot of hardwoods, not, you know, the big pine plantations that a lot of people picture. So it makes it for a unique hunting experience because there's not a lot of agriculture. You're really just kind of hunting big, giant, open hardwoods. So you're not, I love going to the Midwest because you can pretty much look at a map and say, this is where the deer are. This is where they bed. This is where they feed. And this is where I need to be to intersect. And it's a lot different down here in the Birmingham area.
Yeah. That's what anybody that
is.
Yeah. And that's what everybody ever tells me from the South. It's like you get, it's not like, and I'm lucky, right? I hunt a completely different type of deer here in Iowa than in most places in the country, right? I can walk into just about any finger of timber in an ag field and there's going to be deer there. And it makes it makes it easy, right? As opposed to some places where, you know, especially in states like, I'll use Ohio for an example, that have certain parts of that state are just giant blocks of timber. And it just throws, it's harder to identify their travel routes, their bedding areas and things like that with that type of terrain.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I previously, before moving to Birmingham, I actually lived in Ohio for about 6 years. And,
okay.
So I'm familiar with that terrain, hunting some different parts of that state.
Yeah.
But you know, the deer are 200 pounds plus, and when you get one on the ground, it's substantial. You know, you need two or three of these deer to fill a freezer down here.
Yeah, that's a fact. That's a fact. And I think that's why my buddy down south kills so many of them a year. I can kill two and fill my freezer. He kills like five to fill his freezer. So I always got to give him a little, smack for that. But you work for Pradco Outdoor Brands. What is your role there?
So I'm the general manager of the Signature Game and Land Management Group. So Pradco's got, you know, three kind of pillars that stand up the company. You've got our fishing division, which is about 20 brands based out of Fort Smith, Arkansas. And then we have two general hunting groups. One is Moultrie Mobile, and it's a pillar all in itself because those are our connected devices, connected cameras, et cetera. And then we have my group, which consists of Moultrie, Summit, Code Blue, Whitetail Institute, Texas Hunter, and a couple other small brands in our umbrella. So we're kind of more of the hunting, the game and land management core of the Pradco group.
Gotcha. And then fishing, of course.
And then fishing, correct, which is your fishing lure brands out of our.
Yep. Okay. All right. So and how long have you been working with Pradco or in the hunting industry?
So I've been with Pradco for 6 years. I've been in the hunting industry since I was in high school. So well over 25 years.
Okay.
Started at retail, went on the road as a rep, worked for a lot of different brands out there. Did that for about 6 years, did 6 years of sales management in that same world before moving down here to Pradco. And since I've been here, I came in, you know, in a sales role, quickly transitioned over into more of a product development role. And now manage the brands I've mentioned previously.
Okay, cool. Let's talk a little bit about being a brand rep. And you mentioned hitting the road. And one question that I get a lot from, whether it's people on Instagram or emails, you know, I've been doing this podcast thing since, I want to say 2014 now. And a lot of the questions that people ask me are, how can I get into the hunting industry? And obviously all these brands want to sell their product. And I always say, hey, find a brand and ask them, you know, how you can work for it. Talk to us a little bit about what the life of a brand rep is like.
Yeah, so when you're on the sales side as a brand rep, I always told people the best way to get into it is to start at the bottom. And when I say the bottom, that's a horrible way to put it. start at retail. If you really want to be on the road selling retailers, you can't talk to them about the products and what products fit best for their consumers without that experience of being behind the counter, hearing all those people come through the door, the issues that they're facing, the things that they like. That really transpires into really being able to go out there and represent different brands, especially if you're going to be an end user of those brands. You have to have that experience. So I always thought retail was a great way to get into it. That's what I did when I was in high school and through my college career when I was at Penn State, worked in retail. And then really kind of later into my college career, I started pro staffing. And so there's a lot of these reps that are out there that have, you know, giant 3-4 state territories. And a lot of those stores have promotions, especially in the fall on the weekends. And that one rep that covers that big of an area can't be at all those different stores. So they have what they call pro staff, and they can go out there and represent those brands on the weekends in their stay. So they can cover one store, you can be at another one. You know, there's not a lot of money in it, but it's still gaining that experience. You're out there talking to consumers. Now you're starting to wear some brand shirts. And then, you know, obviously any type of secondary education is helpful. And then really it's just starting to ping the reps that you're helping to try to get into either their group or if they can, you know, insert you into their network to start building a relationship with some of those brands that are out there.
Yeah. So it sounds like that role would be
just a lot of networking.
Yeah. It sounds like that role would be perfect for somebody who is looking to get their foot in the door. Someone who has little to no experience. And I guess I'll just say like right out of high school, right out of college with maybe a passion for the outdoors.
Absolutely. And so in my career, I've hired people right out of college and it's been, you know, a great experience. They learn a lot. You know, you have to be patient with that because it's a learning experience. So not every time is going to be a success. And then we also had a lot of people that were, you know, later in their careers that were doing something maybe they didn't enjoy, but they always had a passion for hunting. And if it was in sales or some type of function like that, it really dovetailed over well into, you know, being a hunting brand rep out there in the field. And so I don't want to just pigeonhole it to someone out of college, just, you know, that's the only way to get into it. You gain experience different ways. Sometimes you're going to gain a very similar experience in a different market. And so if you're, you know, in your 40s, 50s and want to change, there's definitely opportunities in the hunting market as well.
Yeah. And you hit a buzzword that a lot of people maybe use but don't understand actually what it means, and that's pro staff. And you know, we've seen the pro staff memes out there on social media making fun of people who call themselves pro staff, but in all actuality, what is a pro staff individual?
So pro staff individuals, and again, a lot of them would have been full-time teachers, firefighters, police officers. It's a part-time, it's promotional staff. A lot of people think pro staff means professional, but it really means promotional. And so what they're doing is they're learning the brands, they're learning, you know, what are the key things for each of these, you know, key products that are in this brand's portfolio, and how do I tell a consumer about it? How do I deliver that message and put it in a way that they're going to understand and resonate with? And so it's a great learning experience for somebody who wants to be a brand rep to start as a promotional staffer, go out there, work the weekends, you know, right down there in the trenches, and you kind of start honing your craft that way. And it's really a great way if you've never even been in sales before to start building some salesmanship, some sales experience doing it. So that's really, from my experience, that's what I consider a pro staffer.
Yeah. Okay. This leads me to think of a couple questions in regards to dealers, because we have these people who go out to the dealers, and just from where you sit and your experience in the outdoor industry, talk to me about your thoughts, your opinions, maybe if this is even necessary anymore, of a dealer versus going and getting, like me going to an official bow shop, or me going and talking with a mom and pop dealer versus, which seems to be going the way of direct to consumer or even big box store type product sales. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and again, they're all my customers, and I don't want to, you know, pigeonhole one against the other, but I grew up in a dealer network, grew up, you know, working at a retailer, gun shop, archery shop, and there's definitely still a spot for them. And I'll be honest with you, they're kind of the local bloodline. I really feel that a lot of these brands are created at that level. It's word of mouth. The small dealers out there, they have the ear of that consumer in that area. They're more of your experts, right? So if you want to go in there and you want to get your bow tuned, everybody knows the local bow shop. They know who the tech is, and that's who they're going to go take their bow to because they trust them. So they definitely fill a niche that maybe isn't available at some of the national accounts and some of the box stores or, you know, e-commerce, you know, consumer direct type businesses. You do get that direct regional, you know, what deer scent's working, what yeah. attractant's working best in this area. You know, what's the best time to be out there in the field? You're going to get, whether it's from that person behind the counter or it's the guy over there in the stool, you know, that's just a customer at the store, just in there chewing the fat and listening to them. That's where you get a really big value out of the dealer network. I've gotten to Findy for dealers just because that is my background. National accounts do a great job of helping us market our brands and put them into multiple places across a giant network. But I don't ever want to overlook the value of the independent retailer out there, both from the firearm side and the archery side, of having that expertise of somebody that, you know, has sold two scopes 2 years ago. He's still working in that store and he's hearing rave reviews from that person that comes back in and speaks to it. Or the guy that tuned this guy's bow is telling his buddy, you know, go see this guy. And so when you do that, there's a comfort level in that area with that store's expertise, and those consumers will keep going back there. Now, maybe those stores can't carry all the products that are out there. And that's where obviously the national accounts, those big box stores come in handy as well, because they do have a bigger footprint. They can stock more items. And so if they're hearing about something maybe isn't in stock at a local dealer, that's going to push them to some other places. So I think even for the national accounts out there, they depend on the independent dealer network as well to help drive that business and help drive just consumer awareness.
Right. And I'm like you in a certain sense, where I really do feel that, unlike, I don't know, one of the last things that I bought that I had to do some thinking on, me and my wife bought some furniture. All right. I honestly didn't give a shit about it enough. Right. There's no culture really around furniture. It's like, I'm going to buy this because my wife thinks it matches our living room decor that she wants, whatever. Okay. Let's go here. Let's buy it. Let's get home. Unlike the hunting community, which in my opinion, there's this culture. And I feel like without the dealers, the mom and pop stop, you know, the local hangouts, like you mentioned, that culture suffers. And you're losing something.
Absolutely.
So
yeah, and that's where, you know, I think everybody's got that experience that they've had at an independent dealer with that culture. You know, it's a community. It's something that you're always welcomed into as well. That's the other thing I would say just about the hunting community in general. You know, everybody's got an opinion,
right?
But I would say it's a very small industry, but everybody is very respectful to each other and their different methods. You're always going to get some bad apples out there. No, not everybody's going to want to share their trail cam pictures with you and tell you where they hunt. But in general, people appreciate other people that enjoy the sport.
Yeah. And I think from my standpoint as an end user or a consumer from those dealers, and someone who goes to both the mom and pop shops and the big box stores, and does the direct to consumer as well, depending on product, or whether or not I'm planning for something or I need something last minute. Right. So I feel like my come up when I was younger and just getting into archery and hunting, I would rely on the feedback from the dealer themselves, the business owner, telling me, hey, you don't need this, or try this, or I like these broadheads, or I like, you know, I like this trail camera here, or whatever the case may be. And then at the same time, they, you know, when they're fixing your bow or something like that, they can tell you, okay, well, here's how you adjust this sight, and here's how you do this. And you're getting this education that you wouldn't get anywhere else.
Absolutely. And that's where you build the trust. And I think, you know, it's the same thing with, you know, like my wife, she's got one hairdresser that she'll go to. She has a trust with them.
Yep.
You get the same type of expertise and trust when you have somebody that's working on your bow and you bring a pack of broadheads over to them. And these broadheads are $49.99, and they say, you don't need those. I'm telling you right now, go get those over there. They're $39.99. You're going to save $10, and yeah, they're more effective.
Yeah.
And so when you feel that somebody's not trying to oversell you, or, you know, they're steering you in the right direction, you don't forget that.
Yeah. Yeah. And the fact, I know this guy spends just as much time in a tree stand as I do, as opposed to some guy who's maybe only working there, I don't know, to get into, like, to get through school, or it, this is just his job. They don't necessarily even hunt at times. So, I miss that in certain scenarios.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. 100%.
All right. So, now, what you mentioned, that one of your jobs now is product development. Okay. And I'm fascinated by this aspect of the hunting industry specifically, because I am a hardcore hunter, right? I that's the badge that I wear. I'm a bow hunter. I love to bow hunt. I do a lot of research every year on what gear I want to purchase versus, you know, where I want to save versus where I want to spend more, and things like that. And I always get a kick out of a company, like certain companies introduce new products every single year, even when I feel that those companies have a sufficient product already, right? And that, for example, I'll just use Broadhead Company X. Broadhead Company X has a really badass broadhead, but yet they introduce a new broadhead every year for some reason. Why do companies put so much energy, weight into product development every single year?
So there's obviously there's two different things. One, it is because you found a new technology that, or a new way to do something that is better or it's more efficient. Two is, you know, freshness, newness. If you have the same thing for, you know, decades, I'll tell you that there's actually some anomalies there that you're right. It probably isn't needing new every year, but to get that load in, you know, when you're selling into accounts all across the country and you have a new product, you're getting a full load in versus, you know, the next year they've carrying over some inventory. They're not going to buy as much. So I think there's a lot of companies that do that. For us here, really over the last 5 years, we've really slimmed down our catalog. Went back, really kind of focused and honed in on A items. I think Summit is a great example of that, where we were into ground blind. We were into climbing tree stands.
Yeah.
Obviously, we were in hang-ons, we were in the ladder stands, and it almost got to the point where we were way over-skewed, even on climbers. Where really the Summit Viper is, you know, our flagship, and how do we make the Summit Viper different? So for the last 2 years, that's where we really started getting the self-leveling technology, where you can adjust to the tree stand without having to descend and readjust, instead of just coming out with a Summit Viper with a different color seat, or this one now has a shooting rail or a footrest included in the box. We don't need to do that anymore. And I think what's nice about our group and our product managers is we have dedicated people to each one of these categories that focus on a daily basis. We rationalize our SKUs over and over to make sure that if we have something that's slow moving, we just need to get rid of it. We need to move out. Let's focus on the core. Let's quit trying to reinvent the wheel. And just let's look at constant improvement on our A items.
Yeah.
And so in doing so, we try not to upset that apple cart. We also take a lot of feedback from, you know, outside of our walls. You can't have just a couple people sitting around in an office all day just drumming up ideas. You're setting yourself up for failure. So we take a lot of feedback from our influencers that we partner with. And then really a lot of the items that we come out with, and sometimes we're ahead of them and we get product ideas coming through our portal on our websites that, you know, we've already got in development and we're launching in 60 days. But it's kind of just positive reinforcement that we're doing the right thing, because we do get a lot of input from consumers out there, whether it be on social media or through our new product submission forms, things like that.
How do you market a product? Let's just say, to elaborate on the example that you used in the Summit Climber. Because for me, I live and die by like the old Lone Wolf tree stand. It's now Novex. Okay, I have I'm a mobile guy. That's my holy grail. A lot of guys, especially in the South, they rely on that that Summit climber. And those are the two products that I feel don't necessarily need the marketing dollar because they're just they're above that. How do products get to that point?
It's decades.
Yeah.
It's not, well, it's two things. One, it's the product itself.
Right.
You mentioned the Lone Wolf Climber. That's something that you had a lot of success with, you're comfortable with, and that's great. And if you're comfortable and you're obviously climbing a tree and that's what you feel safe in, then please continue to use that item. For us, it's been with that Viper Climber, the Goliath and the Titan for those that are maybe a little 100 pounds. But when people use the product for years and years on end, I mean, these things don't, you know, die out. It's not like a consumable product that you're going to use for a year or two and then pitch it. These are products that people have hanging in their, you know, garages for 10, 15 years plus.
Yeah.
We're looking for ways to get that person that, you know, we can only sell so many in a single year to a single person, especially on something like a climber. There's not a lot of people that have six climbers, but they might have six ladder stands.
Right.
So how do we improve that product to make somebody that already owns one want to come back and get an upgraded version of it? And that's kind of where product development comes in. And that's what I feel like we've been doing a good job with, you know, the Viper Pro, the Viper Pro level, because we have a ton of Summit consumers out there that live and die by Summit. And now we're able to give them something fresh, something new, something that they've probably been in the tree stand themselves and kind of gripe a little bit about, man, I wish there was a way to level this thing up without having to climb down the tree, or just ways to make the stand safer or just more comfortable. That's really the crux of product development for us, especially on that Summit side.
Yeah. How does a company know, and you can talk about the market in general or just from your experience at Pradco, how does a company know when to introduce a new product versus make adjustments to a current product?
I think the market kind of tells you that. You know, I, after so many years, I mean, we're very analytical here. So we look at sales, we look at point of sale trends that are out there, and just a lot of consumer feedback. And the market will tell you when it's time. It's not something that we can just put up on a board and say, okay, we're going to go work on a 5 or 10 year roadmap, and we're going to introduce, you know, this widget this year, and then 5 years from now, we're going to introduce this widget with this technology. Because if we're talking about switching from, like, say, tree stands over to game cameras, you know, there could be a new chip coming out that no one's ever heard of in 6 months. And that changes the entire game of how we could spec a camera, what we get the flash to, or the megapixels, or the trigger speeds. So that was something there that the market dictates it, or the technology dictates it. It all really depends on what product you're specifically talking about.
Yeah. Talk about in your guys's experience, there's I'll use saddle hunting for example. There are people who feel that saddle hunting is a fad and that eventually it's going to go away, right? But saddle hunting has been around long enough now on this. I feel like this is the second go round of saddle hunting. The first one happened, you know, in the 90s or whatever, that back when I first started bow hunting, but now it seems like it's going to be here to stay. How do you guys determine whether to jump in on a quote unquote fad versus knowing if that has any validity and then you get into that market as well?
Yeah. So it's interesting you brought that one up. So, you know, in my career, you know, back, I think in the period that you're talking about, you really had two that were out there with Ambush and then Green's Tree Saddle, which eventually turned into Trophy out there today. And I actually had worked with that brand in a previous life.
Oh, cool.
I think, you know, it's definitely probably had more of a fad feel back in the day. I personally love them myself. I think there's a market there for a consumer to have a climbing tree stand and a saddle, especially when I was living in Ohio. And there's a lot of agriculture in that area of Ohio that I was living in. And I was butting up right against, you know, neighboring farms, fields. I didn't want to leave a bunch of climbing sticks or a tree stand in the tree, because when they're out there in their fields, they're going to see my stand. It's also not a straight tree. I can't get a climbing tree stand in it. That saddle made it very nice to be able to go up, hide the sticks on one side of the tree, hang when I needed to hang, and then get out and be very quiet going in and out. So And that's coming from, you know, the manager of Summit Tree Stands.
Yeah.
I think that you can't have your eyes closed to other things that are out there. Now, for us personally, kind of getting back to, you know, understanding your brand, I just know Summit is not a brand that is a tree saddle brand. We are a high-end, lightweight, aluminum, comfortable climbing tree stand brand.
Yeah.
And we've got decades of information and failed, you know, entrances in the different markets with that brand that tell us, you know what, let's not get too far away from our base. This is what we're known for. Let's just be perfect at this. Now, if it's starting a new brand and getting into that, there's always that possibility out there. I think that there's a market there. I just personally don't know that it's something that we would want to get into. But I also don't want to shy away and say that, you know, it's a fad and it's going to go away in 10 years, because I think it is here to stay.
Yeah.
And I think it's a great tool for those that want to use it.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question about demographics. And so if this is me not knowing anything about your guys's business with Moultrie and Summit, and this is even before I knew that the company was based out of Birmingham, Alabama, but I could tell you that when I hear Moultrie and I hear Summit, those two brands, I think the South, right? How do you guys take a product or a brand that is synonymous for a certain region in the United States and try to make it popular or introduce it into a different region of the United States?
Well, I think, you know, obviously because it's where it was born and bred is actually both Moultrie and Summit, both were born here in Alabama. Obviously Dan Moultrie, you know, locally here in the Birmingham area, then Summit that was up closer to where you're from, Northern Alabama in Decatur, that those two brands will definitely carry that connotation just because of where they started. But
right,
really the products themselves, you know, it's all done in marketing. It's all done in sales. It's, you know, the effectiveness of your sales force to go out there and convince retailers to, one, you know, stock those products in different areas. And then it's, you know, again, you mentioned those two brands. I look at them as not being based in the South. I look at them as being iconic.
Yeah.
And so they've been able over, you know, you're not going to do it in a year. It's been done over decades of people using those products across the country and saying, you know what, maybe it's started down there, but they're onto something and they're doing something that is effective where I live and hunt as well.
Yeah.
So I really think it's done through marketing and sales and not necessarily through the product, because the product itself for hunting doesn't really have a regionality to it. The only thing that makes something regional would be based on, I'd say, more regulations. You know, the South is pretty lax on baiting, feeding, you know, from Texas all the way over to Georgia. Most of those states, you can put a feeder out and hunt over it. A lot of states up in the North, you can't. You know, Pennsylvania, you're not going to sit there and hunt over a feeder. So I think that's where it's kind of getting its connotation. But in general, the products really aren't regionally based. It's, you know, local regulations that probably restricts it or tags it more than the brand itself.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, when you guys sit around the round table there at Pradco and you say, okay, it's time to start brainstorming about new products or identifying, you know, where there might be some holes in your own lineup to introduce a new product that may compete with another brand or you guys get some market share. What do those conversations look like?
Yeah. And it really kind of starts with, you know, internal reflection on what we currently have, you know, what's working out there, what's not, you know, what did we introduce that failed is probably the best place to start. And then just kind of doing just a quick, you know, discussion on why did it fail? What's the postmortem on that product? Are we going to end its life? Are we going to replace it? Or are we going to walk away from that specific product or category? And then if we are going to replace it, what needs to be replaced? How do we fix it to make it more either usable or consumer friendly? So that's the first thing. Secondly, when we sit down, we do a lot of competitive analysis. You know, what else is out there in the marketplace? Who else is winning? And if it's in a category that we're in, but maybe there's a specific product with a specific technology or a price point or a feature that we don't have, you know, that's where those discussions, and they're lengthy discussions about, you know, could we make it? If we could, what do we think it would cost? What does the price need to be? What does the weight need to be? What does the size need to be? Those are all the different discussions that we're having early on. And even, you know, in the days of e-commerce now, the discussions are going even to, you know, how do we make it smaller? How do we make it ship in its own container versus, you know, just focusing on the product itself and how it's being used in the field. We're thinking way beyond that as far as how's it going to be the easiest to get it into the consumer's hands? What's going to be the easiest way to market it at a retailer, whether it's going to be on a shelf, on a peg, because, you know, real estate at retail is valuable. So we want to make sure that we're owning our space, but we're not taking up too much space that may restrict a retailer from being able to even buy the product.
Right.
So all those different things are kind of on the board when we're having those discussions. Yeah. And then obviously we're trying to have them early enough because that product development cycle is so long. Whether you're, you know, building it here domestically or you're using a third party manufacturer, or if you're going to be importing it, those discussions and those designs, whether it's our internal engineering team or if it's collaboration with some different third parties, they have to be going on very early so we can have product, you know, right now in the field using it before we ever go into, say, an Archery Trade Association show in January and launch it.
Yeah.
So it's just from inception to development to production to testing to all of that before it finally hits a retailer's shelf, it's probably much longer than what many people realize.
Do you ever have any examples of, or maybe instances where the idea came out great, the product came out, it looked good, but once you got into product testing and got it out to a handful of maybe pro staff or people to test before the actual launch, you had to be like, hey man, this isn't as cool as we thought it was going to be.
Yes, I can think of one.
Okay.
we did have one, and we no longer make it, and I guess I don't mind even talking about it at this point. But we did launch one a few years ago, actually, so it's fairly recent. That was, I thought, a great idea. We ended up licensing the design and the technology from someone else that had it, but it was basically a chair backpack. And I thought it was awesome. It was adjustable, so you can get it real low down the ground. If you want to predator hunt, you can, you know, make it more upright to use it like a dove stool, but then you have this backpack, you know, built into it that it all packs down into, that you can carry your shotgun shells or, you know, whatever beverages of choice you wanted to carry into the field with you, but you could literally just throw this thing on your back, walk straight to a blind, and not have to worry about a chair. Price points were good. But once we got it out there in the field, we had a lot of revisions, one, before we ever got it to market, because we were starting to see failure with some of the hardware pieces that our factory had used. So that delayed it a little bit. And I would say we probably made the wrong decision because it did increase the retail a little bit more. And I feel like that was probably its biggest barrier out there in the field, was that it was a higher retail than probably what the market was ready for. And again, it was a Summit branded product, and I just don't know that it resonated with a Summit consumer.
Gotcha.
So it probably needed to be either Moultrie or, you know, or just start another brand and start building it out that way versus using it. It wasn't known for it.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's a pretty good example of what you're asking.
Yeah. So how much weight do you guys put into end user feedback?
I mean, it's everything. Now, obviously, because of constrictions on time, our feedback pools are probably limited to, you know, maybe 30 or 40 people, and, you know, really over a 60-day period. The rest of it is really done through just rigorous testing. You know, on our tree stands, we go through rigorous testing as far as to those TMA standards, drop tests, et cetera. But as far as end usage, you know, we feel like we get a really good idea from our small user group of, you know, say a couple dozen people, but there's always things that come up that consumers will surprise us with, you know, through feedback that it's like, yeah, that would have made a lot of sense. I wish I had thought of that. And, you know, and that kind of gets into those, you know, product changes where somebody comes out and says, hey, I've got another product for you. I'm going to introduce it this year. It's because somebody, whether it was internal or external, figured out a way to either make it more usable or more comfortable or whatever it might be.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to cost, right? I mean, there's people who, and I'll go back to tree stands because this is just fresh on my mind, but tree stands, right? Some of these hang on tree stands now are getting into the $500, $6 or $600, even $700 plus range on certain tree stands. And so there are people out there that are like, yes, I will pay for that. But a majority of people are like, hey, this is an awesome product, but there's no way I'm going to spend X number of dollars on this product. How do you guys combat those conversations or have those conversations? I mean, is it all simply a cost analysis that you guys run to say if a product's going to be profitable or not?
Well, yeah, obviously from our side, you know, there's families to feed and a parent company that really would like us to not lose money every year.
Right.
So we definitely have that side of the analysis. But then, you know, we kind of start out with a target retail in mind. Now, over the last couple of years with all of the different things globally that have caused price increases, whether it be freight and tariffs and raw material increases, some of those retails have drifted up. But when we're coming out with a new product, I would say, you know, a great one would be an example of what I can't tell you about that we're coming out with this year on the tree stand side is we just had a low expectation on performance of sales. We know that maybe we're not going to sell 10,000. We may sell 3,000 because the price point dictates it. But at least it helps round out that assortment so we have something for the consumer that only wants to spend, say, $300 or $400. We also have something with extra bells and whistles that we're adding to the product line that people have been asking for. And we've been telling them if we do that, we can do it, but it's going to be more expensive. And we know that, you know, all the people that say it means that probably 20% will actually probably purchase it. The others just thought it would be a good idea if they could get it for the same price.
Right.
But those are all conversations we have internally. And we try to set realistic expectations for our sales performance and our volume on those higher price points.
Yeah.
They're needed. It's more aspirational. It's the same thing with cars, right? You want to build the Corvette, but you're still going to have the Cobalt. You know, in the Cobalt, you're going to sell a whole lot more of them, but the Cobalt is going to have some styling of a Corvette, you know, whether it's on the lines of the vehicle or something. And you always want to have that aspirational, super high-end, fully loaded part of your assortment. But then you also want to be able to have something out there that says, you know, if the person doesn't care if it has, you know, XYZ features, they really are just concerned about this and this, we have that for them as well.
Yeah. Okay. And I'll tell you this from a serious hunter standpoint, I will complain about the price of a product, but if I have a buddy who buys it and tells me, dude, this is a badass product, I will then probably go try that product out and potentially buy it for the same amount of price that I earlier complained about. So I think, I don't know. I just feel that the hunting, whether it's the serious hunter versus the weekend warrior, however you want to define it. I really do think that, especially with hunting being a hobby or you can call it what you want, a hobby, a passion, or I don't know. It's probably a industry where people spend more money than what they probably should. If that, like, they don't really care about budget, they're just going to be like, yeah, budget's important, but I'm going to buy this still.
Yeah. And I don't disagree. And I would say when we start launching and we've got some product launching on the Moultrie side that is getting into some retails on the feeder front that we've never touched with the Moultrie brand. You know, we're definitely in those retails with Texas Hunter, which is more of a higher end metal, you know, Texas market type of feeder. But you know, we've got some feeders this year for Moultrie that are also starting to drift up that way. But what we see historically is when we start entering those higher price points is exactly what you just said. You know, we set realistic expectations in year one that it's going to perform, but it's not going to perform as well as we probably had hoped. But then we watch year two, year three, and once people start using it, they start telling their friends, and everybody's having these positive experiences, they end up really performing well, but it's really not until year three or year four before they really hit their stride. And then to your point on just, you know, hunting consumers in general, I don't want to say hunting is completely insulated from, you know, the inflation or poor economics, but when we have downturns in the economy like we're having right now, people seem to tighten up a little bit. Maybe they're not going, you know, to three different states and hunting, but they're going to put a lot more money into, you know, their back 40 that they're hunting right there by their house.
Yeah.
And so maybe they're not going to go spend, you know, $3,000 on a deer hunt to go hunt out of state, but they're willing to go spend, you know, another $100 and put an extra feeder or a camera out. And yeah. So for hunting accessories, you know, I would say that curve is much flatter, spiking up or down in different markets or different economic scenarios versus others. And I think it's to exactly what you said. We have a very passionate core hunting group that is willing to spend the money on something, especially if they think that, you know, it's going to perform good for them and it's a hobby that they're passionate about.
Right. Now, there's certain products out there where you have like, let's just again use Moultrie or Moultrie trail cameras. A lot of people can use Moultrie trail cameras. A lot of people can use Summit tree stands. A lot of people can use Code Blue Scents and things like that. But then we have a brand like Whitetail Institute, which is a very niche product, a very niche brand for people who have the ability to plant food plots and things like that. How do you keep a brand like that? I'll just use the word sexy.
Well, I'll be honest with you, with them, it's with Whitetail Institute, it is a very unique product. It's a very, you know, food plotters are, I kind of put them like, you know, waterfowlers or, you know, some of these other kind of niche hunting categories. Mm-hmm. Where when there's an expert out there, there's somebody super passionate about it, they're going to put a lot into it. And so you're right. There's some barriers to entry to putting in food plots. One is obviously land access.
Exactly.
And so if you have the land, do you have the equipment to put the food plots in? And then if you do, you know, how are you going to do it the right way? And that's where kind of Whitetail Institute comes in, is, you know, they're very, very educated on how to put food plots in. I mean, for Whitetail Institute, so you're aware of, they're actually still based out of Hope Hall. So they're actually not in Birmingham. They're just south of Montgomery. When we partnered with Whitetail Institute, we realized quickly that the talent base and the knowledge base inside of those walls down there do not need our influence. You know, that they've created a brand into themselves based on their knowledge and their passion for food plotting. And so if you were to call Whitetail Institute, you're calling directly to their office and you're getting somebody that's a complete expert on that category. On that seed, they can tell you about what's going to perform best in your area, how to do the soil test. And so for that, you kind of need that specialized group of customer service that can walk you through it kind of step by step. And they'll tell you exactly what you need for equipment. Or if you're not going to use this type of equipment, you know, this is what your expectations should be about the performance of the seed. But that's, you're right, it's very niche. But if you can check those boxes where you have the access to the land, you know, food plots work great all over the country. And obviously there's different mixes that grow better in different areas, but having really the talent to answer those questions and the access for somebody just to be able to pick up a phone and get right into somebody immediately and get some answers and some, you know, guidance on what to do and how to do it is invaluable for them. And so I wouldn't say they're trying to be sexy. They're really just trying to be the best at what they do. Just like Summit wants to be the best at what they do now. You know, I would say Whitetail Institute has kind of written the book and actually helped steer some of the other brands on, what's the book, Good to Great, you know, the hedgehog theory, you know, focus on what you do best. And that's what they do best. And their marketing does a really good job. But again, you know, a food plotter is a different hunter. It's not the person that's probably going to be going out 2 weekends a year and, you know, hunting on grandpa's place without putting a camera out. This is the person that really knows their property. They're trying to put a lot back into it. They're trying to grow bigger deer, maybe get an older age class. And so with that, they've got the expertise to help that individual out.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to, I talk about this a lot on the Hunting Gear podcast here, and that is how to make good decisions on what product to buy. And as a person like yourself who not only works in the industry, and works with a variety of different product categories, but yourself, you know, you're also a serious hunter. How would you recommend an end user go about the process of making a decision on any product?
Well, I think a lot of that really hasn't changed, for decades. There's one is probably the most obvious, and I think you alluded to it earlier. is really, you know, who's in your hunting group? Who are your core friends that share that same passion that are, you know, buying products as well? That's really where I still get a lot of input from others that maybe are using something that I haven't used in the past and they're, you know, recommending it. That's still where I get a ton of information on things that maybe at Pradco we aren't making right now, but I'm still interested in buying it because I'm going to go, say, to Colorado and go hunt mule deer. Well, none of our, you know, we're not putting in food plots or putting out deer feeders for mule deer. So that there's a lot of products that I have questions about, and I ask the experts too, is what has changed over the last, you know, several, you know, few decades is just, you know, the internet and being able to really have full access to any information you could possibly need. And I always do start on manufacturers' websites because I feel like they've got the most accurate information. And then from there, I start looking at, you know, there's a lot of YouTube reviews out there, a lot of forums, a lot of different places that you can actually go and get, you know, some, and then obviously social media,
right?
Where you can get some of that positive feedback from there. And then, you know, I see it a lot of times too, where I'm curious about a product and I'll go over to their website, I'll look at it, and then maybe I'll click on their social media site. And if all I see are positive reviews, and then I also see there's a bunch of that are hidden or deleted, I immediately turn away. So I really appreciate some of those manufacturers, and we do a lot of the same where we keep it as open and honest as possible. Obviously, if there's vulgarities in our you know comments, we'll delete those out. But if somebody's having a bad experience, I don't want somebody on our marketing or our customer service team deleting it. I want to be able to read it.
Yeah.
Because I want to take that feedback and see if I can do better as well. So that's where I get a lot of the information is really, you know, from word of mouth is number one, and then two is just from the internet, whether it's, you know, company websites and social media or just on different forums.
Right. And it's funny you mentioned the internet, right? It's been around for so long now, like we can't imagine our life without it. But when I first started buying hunting products, I didn't have that as a reference. And so everything that I learned was at the dealers, like I mentioned, or other hunters, right? Or in print ads and that had nothing bad to say about any product ever. So I feel like there was a much bigger learning curve back then on purchasing products than there was today when anybody can voice their opinion about anything and you can start to see trends on if a product is worth it or not. And so I always get a kick out of, you know, like a product like the Acorn Cruncher or the Deer View Mirror or what was the other one? Those little wafers that I used to pin to my hat when I was younger and you know, all those products that I would never even think about purchasing today, but because it was like, hey, check this out. And so I checked it out and it, you know, didn't help me at all. So I always get a kick out of that.
Right.
So,
yeah, I agree. I had a lot of those memories too of the archery shops and, you know, whether it was Light & Knox when they were first coming out, yep. You know, you really couldn't find a whole lot online, but you'd get, you know, one person say, oh, it's amazing, I watched the Ori through a deer. Another person says, oh, I'll put 15 grains in the back of my arrow, it didn't fly right. And so you get conflicted. But, yeah, it's funny. You're right. It has definitely changed.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, man, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to hop on and BS with us for a while about, you know, the Pradco brands, some of the products that you guys work with, and just the overall knowledge that you have in the space. So thank you very much for your time. And if you do get out in the woods later this year, man, good luck.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks for having me on. And yeah, safe hunting this fall and best of luck to you as well.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.